Mr. Bright, Reel 3.
Right. It had a moat. It had only four gates. And these were guarded by Czech gendarmes, not by Germans. The Germans didn't guard it at all. They had an administrative building in the middle of town, but otherwise they left the guarding to the Czechs. People had been deported to Theresienstadt, which was really only a staging post to Auschwitz, except for, let us put it, let's call them half castes or half Jews, the children of mixed marriages, of whom there were plenty. They were protected from further deportation until September 1943. So they formed a permanent base. People came and went. Therefore, living in Prague came to an end. For us, it came to an end on about the 15th of July 1943. It must have been the day the invasion of Sicily started, because we heard that rumor. Of course, it might have taken some days to reach us, and we said, the war will be over next more time, but of course it wasn't.
Is that what you meant? Yes, what exactly happened then on that day?
Well, what happened was I had helped people. I had to help people to get their things to pick up things together. What you did, what you had to do, you could only put your possession into one bag, like a kit bag, a largish kit bag, and then a horse-drawn removal van would appear on the day before it was loaded, and it was taken to a stadium. You would then make your own way to the stadium, and that's what we did. We had each had a kit bag, and we walked to the stadium where we stayed during the rest of the day and the night. And the next day we were taken by train to Theresienstadt. There we disembarked. And that's how my life there began. If you want me to talk about that?
Please.
Right. Well, obviously everybody was separated. Wives were separated from husbands. These barracks were huge, with huge rooms. And there were bunks two beds high. Many were crammed into it, and there was obviously no privacy. And you had very few of your belongings. It took some time before we got our kit bag that was being searched and examined, and it took some days before we got it. I was with my father on the roof of one of these barracks. I think it was called the Hannover Kaserne, but it doesn't matter. And because there wasn't room anywhere else. Now, these they were also huge, with huge timber beams. Timber the size you don't see anymore. Well, that was 1750, but not now. And you would sleep in a sleeping bag in between them. The spacing was quite wide. And then you would climb over them and took it down. During that time, Danish refugees arrived, and they shared the same loft. I'm afraid we didn't speak Danish, they didn't speak German. And they very much stuck to one another. As a matter of fact, they were treated quite well. They received food parcels, and they understand their return to Denmark before the end of the war. But that doesn't matter now. Then vacancy occurred for me to go to a children's area, a young boys' area below, a floor below. And now vacancies could only occur because there had been another transport. As place become evacuated, there was room for newcomers. And I stayed there for a little while, and in the morning we had to report for work. I was always late. I couldn't get up. It can be easily explained. I couldn't face it. So if you can't face a job, you tend not to get up. That was rather a mistake, because the good drops went first. The good drops were in the kitchen. The second good drops were working outside the ghetto on in gardens to growing vegetables. But I was never early enough for that. And I ended up being like an apprentice in what was known as Bauschlosser, which is a building plumber, which really meant that you made and fitted hinges and locks and keys and do smithwork and things like that. You then went to fit whatever needed, doors and hinges and drawers, and we made keys. We also worked for the Germans. For their wives, we made pushchairs. We made them right from the start, from making our own wheels to the bodies. And we made ornamental. I worked for somebody who was a very good smith. We make ornamental ironwork, such as lanterns. And in the same workshop, they made a very good craftsman making jugs from tin plate. They're very good tinsmiths. They would cut and solder and form things into large water jugs or buckets or whatever was needed. And that wasn't too bad. I was then on getting the food. You went to a central area. That was a privileged job, actually, because there was always a little bit left, and you made sure there was a little bit left that you had, and as an extra. And we would dole it out. And I remember one day I had a bit of some left over, and I gave it to my mother. Well, she couldn't heat it. She ate it just as it was cold, and she had a gallbladder attack or something like that. She suffered from that, and because it wasn't cooked, heated, and that, and she ate it too quickly, she had a terrible attack. She was taken to the hospital. The problem there was that there were very many doctors, and they were very, very good, and they even had some drugs. But because you were so weak, you weren't likely to recover. That's to say, the operation would be successful, but the patient would die, if you see what I mean. Well, she didn't die then, but I remember how ill she was due to me trying to help her. And because of circumstances, I couldn't. Now, my father eventually went from the loft into another accommodation, again shared by dozens of others, a smaller room, but again shared with dozens of others. And he worked on it in a timber yard at first, inside the ghetto, because we needed quite a lot of timber to make these bunk beds. But then he got a job with the police. The original police had been youngsters. They weren't terribly clever. They walked they stuttered around in jack boots and uniforms. Well, they obviously had a uniform, but the Germans took fright, and they sent him to Auschwitz a lot. So they had vacancies for older policemen who posed no threat. The police as such. All one had to do was raise and lower a barrier. As I said, the administrative building was in the center of town, and in order to get there from where the Germans lived, they would pass along a road. Now, that road was crossed by Jews. It was on a square. Was crossed by the inhabitants, the ghetto inhabitants, all day. And then you had to have somebody there who would spy an SS man in the distance. And he would lower the barrier so nobody would cross and get in the way. And then when he passed, he would salute. And when he had gone, he'd lift the barrier. That's really all it was. I mean, you would have duty day and night just to raise and lower the barrier. That's all it was. You had a peace cap. That's all there was. But it did, as it done in Prague, which I haven't mentioned, it meant that we weren't sent away until September, October 43. Had we been sent any earlier, and had my father not got this particular job, I wouldn't be sitting here. Because there are very few people who survived. As a matter of fact, I only know one. The family I mentioned who lived downstairs, who in my block of flats in London, who were sent to Theresienstadt and were sent to Auschwitz. Their son was a doctor. He hadn't quite finished. The Germans moved in on his last month or some craft in the university. He was a doctor as near as a chemist as well. They were in Auschwitz. He was already in a gas chamber. And they had another outbreak of typhus. And they said, is there a doctor in the gas chamber? And so he said, yes. And so he got out. I met him after the war. It was perfectly true. His name is Bloch, Max. And more strange than that, he had a German girlfriend, which was a very dangerous thing to be. But she knew him from the Sudeten. She came to Prague, and she waited for him. And when he came back, they married. And they lived in Teplice-Sushanov, which is the place that I ended up to eventually. That was his birthplace. Now, what happened to him since, I don't know. He may not be alive anymore, but that's about the only survivor I know. Now, there is another one. No, that isn't true. There is a survivor of Lvov, of Litzmannstadt, whom I met in my third camp. He had learned the trade of welder, and the Germans used Jewish labor in the ghetto. Because he was a skilled man, they did not send him away. Again, not until September, October 43, when everybody was sent to Auschwitz to be redistributed to labor camps and factories. And I met him, and in fact, he lived on the bunk above me in the third camp. But he was really an exception because he had a valuable asset, his skill as a welder.
Was there any such thing for you as education in Terezin?
Well, the answer, strictly speaking, is yes and no. There wasn't any. A, there wasn't time. We were working. But I met in this, when I moved down from the loft into this youth area, I made friends with a boy called Popper. He was a year younger than me. He was an utter genius. He knew more about mathematics and physics and chemistry and history and philosophy than I shall ever know. And he kept a diary and code. He could explain anything. And he taught me the elements of trigonometry by the light of a 20-watt bulb. I remember they didn't have strong bulbs to save electricity. And it was extremely valuable later on when I became an engineer. And then when I moved from there to a smaller accommodation, a smaller room, crammed full, there were not two but three bunk beds. You know, we lived in tiers of three. He was there too. And there were some very clever people among us. There was one, Paul Kling, who was a violinist, an utter genius, without whom I would not know what music was. And there were two others, very clever. And we paid a private docent, which is like a junior professor of mathematics, to give us lessons. And we paid him rent. He taught us spherical trigonometry. The point of spherical trigonometry is that the triangle has 270 degrees, not 180, because each corner has 90 degrees, and that sort of thing. And we also did elementary integration and differentiation. In fact, the differentiation and integration of volumes of revolution was taught to me by this poor Popper. And again, it came very, very handy. Because when I started evening classes at the Regency Polytechnic, my English wasn't that good yet. And I was so tired. I was working as a toolmaker apprentice. And that my eyes drooped, but I could manage because I had this knowledge, or this basics. It's also I could say when these Sudeten refugees moved into our block of flats, on the floor below there had been a teacher. He was a professor, but on the continent you're called a professor, even if you aren't very long like here. And he had nothing to do. He had no job, no nothing. And he said, could he teach me to keep him in, could he teach me shorthand and algebra? Well, the shorthand, I didn't go down there very well. It was German shorthand, and I didn't take to it. But algebra, yes. That's to say, algebra, you know, p to the fourth, q to the third, divided by x to the third, and u to the fifth. You know, things like that. And that helped me, too, because I could manipulate figures. Not so much figures as abstracts, x and y's. And that helped. But that wasn't school. That so happened. The same with boy, that so happened. Otherwise, no, there was no education.
Who was in charge of the children's area?
I don't know. There was probably somebody in charge. I don't know. We, in the smaller area, in the smaller accommodation, a corner house, Q 609 it was, you know, since we're square, rectangles, Q and R. Right angles or rests. The town was laid out in rectangles, like an American town. There we had somebody who was in charge, poor devil, who played tricks on him, like cutting the third wire of the electricity and things like that. And he was a poor devil, he took it out on him, I'm afraid. We played sort of pranks, but. There was somebody nominally in charge. Now, you had to have somebody nominally in charge because I suppose if there were transportations and you were on the list, you had to make sure you left. Or you were in. There was a curfew as well that you were in at night or the evening, it was 8 o'clock.
Did you have any contact with what you might call a cultural life in Terezin?
Yes.
Because we have had an opera performed at our museum,
yes,
which was written there.
Yes, that's right. Well, because of this Paul Pavel, I had a musical education. Let's put it that way. Although I can't read a note, he would play all day with audio all day. But otherwise, he would explain to me what a cadenza was, what counterpoint was. He would play anything from Bach. We would discuss classical music, modern music, and I went a lot to his concerts. They were chamber concerts because obviously few people could be accommodated in lofts, but not an orchestra. An orchestra would be a far more difficult thing to assemble. But I remember him practicing for hours on end Schubert's quintet, which I know by heart still to know. I got a musical education, let's put it. I also got a political education because this fellow Popper was also interested in political philosophy, so we discussed things, but there wasn't all that much time for it. One of the members of the quintet was a fellow called Karl Anschau. Karl Anschau was a viola player. But he was a couple in my third camp, and he became a conductor in Prague, and then became a conductor in Toronto. I think he died soon, but I got his records, because I happened to know him.
What was he like as a man?
He was very good. He was a communist, but he was very good to us. It was the third camp was most extraordinary. We were taken there to make aluminium propellers in groups of three or four. A group of three propellers had to be made to fit and balanced or four. And for reason I've never explained, we also had children there. Now normally children would be killed on arrival. But we had fathers and a few fathers and their sons with us. And he was a couple, his portfolio was to look after children. And I was one of them. I thought I was 15. So he didn't sort of much, didn't have much of a job, but he would try to get us a bit extra food. I remember they brought in a dead horse. Well, we were given that. That was quite something. We didn't get to know him that well, and he also escaped. There were two groups of three who escaped just before the end of the war. It was nothing to get excited about because they simply walked to the nearest farmyard and said, can you put us up? The reason being that the Russians were moving closer and closer, and the Germans wanted to drain up the brownie points. Under the circumstances, they thought hiding a Jew would be good coming good. And in fact, when the Russians moved in, which wasn't until the day after the war ended, they just came back within five minutes left. They hadn't gone very far. I think Anschel had been an officer in the army, although he wasn't all that old. In fact, the couples and the seniors in the camp had been officers, either in the Polish army or the Czech army or the Austrian army. The chief SS man insisted on that. He was an officer in the First World War, and he wanted, although they were Jews, he wanted to deal only with officers. And so it gave it a sort of a military slant.
Now, we've jumped ahead a little bit. If we can just go back to the autumn of 1943, when I think you left Terezin.
Yes, well, in Terezin, I worked like a metal worker. You know, I thought I'd learn something. And my mother worked as a seamstress. And but where do you want to be in 43 or...
The autumn of 43, I think you said you left?
No, sorry, that's wrong. Autumn 44.
Ah, that makes more sense.
In 43, we were in July 43, we arrived in Theresienstadt 15 months later, which is September, October 44 we left. I'm sorry, it's 44.
Yes, I thought you would have been longer in Theresien.
Yes, it was 15 months. So I worked as this metal worker, and then they emptied the ghetto altogether. No, we didn't know the reason, but it was emptied from September onwards. My father was sent in September, and my mother in army in the middle of 21st, probably it was. Of October. I didn't quite know when. I knew that my birthday was the 7th of October. My mother had moved into better premises because there were fewer people. Suddenly there were so many less. She was able to move into where you had a single bed rather than two or three. And she managed to make a custard she got some powdered milk and some custard powder, and on my birthday she made a custard, and I remember that. So it can't have been the 7th, which my birthday, it must have been a week later that we were sent. As a matter of fact, I've now got a date sent from Liverpool by somebody who'd been to Czechoslovakia, got a book of all the inhabitants of Theresienstadt, when they arrived, when they left, and I've got a copy lying there on the table, and I think it was the 21st. I'm not too sure whether I got the dates right, but it was then that we were put on a train. Now, again, it wasn't a cattle train, it was an ordinary train. Locked doors, but that's what happened then. Now, I think my mother could have stayed. You worked for the German armament, and they made some sort of sunglasses to cut out the glare from snow on the eastern front. There is a mineral which is used as insulator. Was used as insulator in electric irons, and they used that as a lens. Anyway, she could have. Had she worked, she would have been protected, but she wanted to join her husband. We didn't know where he'd gone to, but she was going to join him. And that was it. Now, do you want me to carry on from there? Well, we were put on this train, and we were handed half a loaf or something. So that was quite useful. And we had come along. We all had a seat. It wasn't that uncomfortable. And we arrived at Auschwitz. Well, as you drive in, you see the barbed wire. You see guards. You see guards hitting people. You see these people in striped uniforms. And one in the compartment who had been in a concentration camp. Actually, people had been taken to concentration camps before the war and let out. Usually let out on condition they would leave. An uncle wouldn't mind what happened to him. But he said, good Lord, that's a concentration camp. That's all he really knew. And then we stopped, we disembarked, we were put into lines six abreast, two lines of six abreast. And I was with my mother, but somehow I lost her. But she spotted me, and she walked towards me, shook my hand, and walked away again. And then we were taken in front of somebody who would point right or left. And again, we didn't know. Obviously, we didn't know what it was all about. And there were lorries waiting. And those who were ill or crippled or old were told they can get onto this lorry. And we thought, how nice, you know, to be so kind. Anyway, I'd seen my mother go first, and she walked to the left. And I'm never that much withered. I'm never that much conscious of what happened. I'm a bit slow on the uptake. So when it came my turn, I walked forward. Didn't take much notice of the man in front, and simply followed where my mother had been, had gone to the left. But I was called back and turned to the right. And we then assembled those who had been asked to go right, and again we were marched. By that time it was in between a roadway, as it were, between barbed wire. There must have been camps on either side, or sub-camps, and the soldiers asked us for watches. They knew that if they didn't get it, somebody else would. They said, would we let them have watches? We would lose them anyway. And I think some people gave them their watch. And then we would come to a stop, and I remember that I stood at an open door, and there were women in there who had just presumably also arrived, and they had their head shorn. And we eventually had our hair cut, and I never seen a naked woman before, but to see a naked woman absolutely shorn is a bit of a shock. And then it came our turn, and we had to undress completely, and anybody who had a support for hernia, so I could put it to one side, I think even false teeth, I'm not sure, but that's certain things like that. And we had to take everything off, keep nothing except shoes. We had a shower, but nothing to dry ourselves with, as it was October, it was quite cold. We were issued then with pants which were made of the prayer shawls. Now that was, as it so happened, an excellent thing, because prayer shawls were made from the finest wool, so it was handy. Some sort of shirt, I can't remember, and a dreadful black jacket.